Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is July 5th, 2006. Today's session is entitled Muslims in Europe, presented by Nellie Van Doorn Harder. The number is VA-N-2006-07. Let's listen in.
Last Monday, we looked at the different issues that have been in the news this last year that concern Muslims, and we tried to, you know, analyze and explain what is behind those issues. We had, we looked at the cartoon, what I call the cartoon wars. Everybody knows what I'm talking about, and we looked at this case in Afghanistan where someone had become a Christian, and that was at the front of the newspaper. And we looked what else did we look at? Hamas, the election of Hamas and Hezbollah in Lebanon and the Muslim Brotherhood. So we just looked a little bit at what all was brewing in the world. And then we're not late at all. I just kind of started to remember what we were doing Monday. What we left out so far was the whole cartoon issue, what exactly was behind it, right? We didn't really talk about that, did we? We mentioned it, but we didn't really, because they said, well, we're going to talk about Europe what is today?
Wednesday.
It's 3 days, you know, they knock you off. And so that is what I want to start with. Like, if we think Europe and Islam, what do we think? Anything that comes to mind there? What has made the headlines?
France, riots.
What else?
Turkey and the EU.
Shall I write it down? Europe has so many countries, it just makes you dizzy. You know, they only. I'm now living in the States. I really. Is that Turkey or is it?
Yeah.
Okay. So that's how you write the country.
It's
not the bird.
It's the same.
Oh, it's the same. Okay. The bombings in London, right? And in Madrid a while ago. And then thinking back, remember the famous murder of the filmmaker Van Gogh in the Netherlands. I think we can start taping now. We are now at the point where we're really starting. So we heard, the GB isn't upright. We know that's Great Britain. So, there has been a lot of unrest, news of unrest coming out of Europe. It's really as if all of a sudden, not 9/11, but especially this murder of Van Gogh, accelerated so many feelings of discontent, of mutual hatred, of dissatisfaction, of feeling disowned, both Muslims feeling that way, and non-Muslims feeling that way. And so if we now think about Europe for 1 minute, we have to first go back to how Muslims came in and when. This is not the first time that there are Muslims in Europe. Remember the golden times of Spain, when a large part of Spain was the Moorish Empire. Mm-hmm. So that we had till about the 15th century or 16th century. Then we had, of course, the Ottoman Empire that marched up, and even Luther, I don't know who of you read Luther, who commented on Muhammad, the Prophet Muhammad, and the Mohammedans, as they called Muslims in those days, they marched up all the way to the gates of Vienna. So there was at one point a lot of thinking going on in Europe. What if we become Muslim? Or I don't think they thought that far, but they knew there was an enemy coming, and they knew that enemy had a different religion. And then, of course, I'm not even mentioning the other way around, the movement the other way around, the Crusades, where from Europe they marched up to liberate Jerusalem and to be in the Muslim country. But what we are now seeing is several waves of Muslims coming in. First of all, in the reconstruction after the Second World War, countries like the Netherlands, Denmark, basically Germany, Norway, all the some of the northern European countries needed workers. They needed workers. They didn't have enough people to do the menial work. So they invited people to come from Morocco and Turkey, but in those days also from Spain and Italy. Those were guest workers too, but Portugal. But a lot of them have gone back. So there was this whole influx of guest workers, and those were mostly married men who left their families behind. They came along, and then they sent the salary back, and the idea was, this is temporary. And that is the big problem, the word temporary. That they all started out with this mindset, in 10, 20 years, these people have saved enough, and they'll go back. This is not what happened. Because, you know, they stayed, and then the wife came, and the family came over, and then cousins, and second cousins, third cousins, everybody came over, and slowly communities started to form. So that is one wave of Muslim believers coming to Europe. And that is why you have different people in different countries. You have in the Netherlands, Moroccans, in Turks, a lot of Turkish people. In Germany, mostly Turkish people. But then the other wave is from the former colonies, of course. Right? And if you think England, from India, Pakistan, Bangladesh, from the former colonies, that you have mostly in France. In France, you have a lot of people from Algeria. And also, actually, the very first Muslims in my country, the Netherlands, were from Indonesia, were Indonesians, who when Indonesia became independent of the Netherlands, who chose to move to the Netherlands. And then the second wave were people from Suriname. Have you ever heard of them? You know, there were a lot of Muslims in Suriname that came to the Netherlands. So we have all these different waves. And then the third wave, which is a little bit more recent, are refugees. You know, the world has been upside down since the last, 25 years almost, and refugees are coming from Somalia, from Ethiopia, a lot of them are Muslim, and of course from Europe itself, former Yugoslavia, Bosnians, lots of Bosnians. So what does this tell us? I've now mentioned so many communities and nationalities, and within these nationalities, ethnicities. What does this tell us about the communities in Europe? Totally mixed up. You cannot speak of one community. You cannot speak of one language. And I think we've all heard about Mohammed Atta, didn't we? Uh-huh. Yeah, we all know the mosque he came from, right? Who has heard the mosque where Mohammed Atta worshipped in Hamburg? Who has read? Do you remember what that mosque was? There was in a building. There were four mosques in that one building. One was Saudi Arabian, the Wahhabi, the very extremist, puritanical Muslims. The other one, if I'm not mistaken, was Somalis, something African. And another one was a mystical mosque, and the fourth one was a Bosnian mosque. And of all places, do we know where it was? Red light district. Why? What do you think?
Cheap.
What?
Converts. Inexpensive building.
Cheap. Yeah. Right. The property, you know, property value was very, very low. So now we immediately understand what had come over Mohammed Atta. Every time he went to the mosque and stepped outside, he was sure the world was coming to an end. Because, you know, he was in the red light district. Think about it. But you see, that by itself, this one mosque shows that in this one building, there had four mosques, and they were all very different from each other. And I'm pretty sure they didn't mix. They didn't mix. Because there's a matter of different languages, different ethnicities, also different social class, you know? And also different, let's say, branches of Islam that people followed. So there's a huge variety, and that's why we can't really talk about all the countries. We have to almost address one or two countries only and analyze what is happening there. But what is very important is to remember this. The picture that sets the tone about Islam in Europe is man. Male that have very low education. You know, the male guest worker with a very low education, who actually never really learned the local language because he thought that he was going back. That is somehow what somehow is the standard assumption of a Muslim in Europe. And of course people forget that a lot of people did get education, they did go up in the system. A lot of people, well, we are now in the second, third, even fourth generation that was educated in those countries. So that picture really is totally off, right? But think about it. You are from the third generation. You've done Danish or Dutch school. You've gone to the university. You have actually quite a good job. And you're still looked upon as an illiterate, male, whatever. And when they see you in a veil, they still think you are, you know, totally suppressed by that illiterate male. So this is the first thing that we don't have here in the U.S. Are we missing a meeting here? So, what is this for?
Okay.
Well, oh, staff meeting. Oh, okay. I'm leaving. No, but you see, that is the perception is very strange. That's one thing we have to keep in mind. The perception of what is happening of the local population. I'm just writing there. You know what I mean. Perception. Now let me see. But what comes out, you know, when you are in Europe, what comes into the news is two things now, because we have this original model, and then we have from the second or third or fourth generation a new model, which is the extremist, right? The male young extremist who has landed in a mosque like the one Mohammed Atta landed in, or who gets his information from the internet. That is the second model. So you see, really very bad ideas go around about Islam. And what comes in the newspaper? Everything that goes wrong. Everything that goes wrong. Like you in Turkey, for example, you have or in Germany, you have a lot of Turkish group from Anatolia who still practice the honor killings. Do we all know what an honor killing is?
No.
An honor killing is mostly... almost always the woman is killed when she has tarnished the honor of the family by, and this can go very far, by being pregnant, unmarried, by dating someone her parents do not approve of, or by even being seen holding hands with someone her parents do not approve of, or even having heard by rumor, having been heard holding hands. That by itself can get you killed if you come from the wrong part of the country and the wrong family, right? And so the honor killings are at the front page of the newspaper, right? And then the other issue that's on the front page, what do you think that is?
Terrorism.
And there's another one. We are looking here at these different groups that have different cultures, and that also then have different branches. I'm now going to call terrorism a branch, okay? That's a certain interpretation of Islam. So you get only the extreme expressions you hit the newspaper. Now culture, I mentioned honor killing. The other one, we all have heard of Ayan Hirsi Ali, right? Have we heard of her? I pass it around, thanks to Tom, where are you? There, Tom gave me this newspaper just now. Ayan Hirsi Ali came to the Netherlands as a refugee from Somalia, and she became a member of parliament. Maybe you heard about her now. She was actually the one who wrote the script for the movie Submission made by Van Gogh, for which he was killed for. And I still think the man could still be alive if she would have made that script a little different. Any of you saw the movie? Well, what would you think? The movie is that you see the body of a Muslim woman with Quran text written on the body. Now, what would you think about a near pornographic movie with Bible texts on it, with women who's, you know, naked woman Bible text? What would you think? Who would say I would be slightly affronted?
Extremists.
Huh? What?
Extremists, perhaps.
Yeah, but would you kill for it?
No.
But would you be like, why do they put Bible texts on the body? Wouldn't you think about that? Wouldn't you find it a bit odd? So So it was the move. She, I think by doing that, she really wanted to provoke. And she knew everybody who saw that movie was just waiting for him to be killed. Because you know there is someone who's going to get up and say, oh, this is slander of Islam. I have to do something. Okay.
And
so,
also the author, Salman Rushdie, that's always been in the news.
Right. Salman Rushdie's always been in the news with the satanic verses. He brought something up, you know, in a book that should be kept silent. That it should, you know, the satanic verses are. Do we all know what the satanic verses are? Who does not know? Okay, very quick. There are several verses in the Quran where the Prophet Muhammad had the inspiration that he should accept the polytheistic goddesses of the old Meccan faith. And then the awareness was this was not an inspiration from God, but from Satan. Of course, if you accept those three verses, the whole basis of the Quran is gone. If you believe that the Quran comes straight from God and you believe that some verses come from the devil, then you start, you know, cynical Western mind start to think which comes from where. But that's another topic. Now, from culture, you said honor killings. Honor. Honor is big. The other is what you call female genital mutilation. That is what Yahya Nesh Ali became very famous about. She really brought that in the news in the Netherlands, which is female circumcision. Female circumcision. That is also something that's practiced, and all these practices are taken with to Europe. And what is the result? Like we spoke about Monday, what did we say? What is really the end result of everything that's going on? Well, how does the local population feel? What? Fear. Fear. We said the local population gets terribly afraid of what is happening. Okay, they kill their own daughters, next thing is they kill mine. You know, my daughter marries maybe someone from Turkey, and she's going to be killed. And you know, people start to think in all kinds of ways. But what do we have when we look in this whole spectrum? The problem is that, and the big difference is with the States, that in most of the communities we do not yet have enough intellectuals and leaders. And that is really the problem. The problem is not really honor killers and female genital mutilation. That happens, but it's incidental. It's bad when it happens, but it is something like when someone murders his or her whole family in the state. That is not the norm, right? I hope.
Right.
That's not the norm, right? So these things that might have been the norm at one point, that might still be the norm in some countries, although, you know, it depends where you are, and a lot of local groups fight against those practices. That's something we forget, that there are many local groups fighting against honor killings and saying this is inhuman, it doesn't fit the 21st century. But the big problem is that there is no leadership. No leadership. Well, so what we are actually seeing is a vacuum in authority. Have you ever thought about that? A huge vacuum in authority, especially religious authority. That is what we're looking at. Because, if I write this, can you follow me? Right? Because what happened? These people come here, they're illiterate, they've had a smattering of the Quran, and they don't bring their leaders. Only later on, leaders are flown in. But that is, I'm talking about 10, 20 years later, right? So their kids are by now teenagers. Their kids hear others, they are better educated. And they sit in the mosque and they hear these preachers. And this is really interesting what these preachers do. Have you read any of these sermons lately? You know, that you can find them on the net. For example, there's been research in the different countries what these preachers actually are saying. And what they really are saying, so here we are. We are, let's say, in Seattle. And we fly in an Amish pastor, okay? So what will he tell the fine people in Seattle? Stay away from dangerous society. Stay away from democracy, because if you have democracy, it means you're not ruled by a Muslim ruler. Stay away from everything else, like nail polish, doing your hair, earrings, And stay away from everything that somehow is connected to the society where you live. So the day you are, you're 16, 17, you go to high school, regular high school in Denmark or in the Netherlands, you sit there and listen to that preacher. What would you do? Ignore it, right? You ignore it. You say, the guy is from Mars. So who does he reach? Your dad.
Yeah.
From the country. Does he reach your mom? No. She doesn't care about the guy. He only reaches your dad because your dad kind of also feels homesick. Oh, this wonderful preaching. I haven't heard this for years. And your dad thinks, oh, this is what we really should do here, build a good and tight community. So you see there are all these gaps. So where do these kids go? To the internet. Where do they turn? To, let's say, wandering preachers, roaming preachers that come by from different countries and that they are attracted to. And if you have bad luck, one of them is a very extremist preacher. You see, so the authority, that is the huge issue. Now, this comes out in Europe. But let me tell you a secret. It's an enormous problem all over the Muslim world. Did you know that? Because young people, well-educated people, people with a little bit of broader vision, you know, they don't care about rambling imams any longer. They need another model of a religious leader who not just only quotes the Quran, but can put that Quran really in the 21st century. And when you have those preachers, there are some you can actually, if you have a dish, you can watch them on your dish. Did you know that? Because they're on TV. You can see them here on TV. And they have big hair like the evangelical pastor, preachers, you know, on TV, huge, you know, lots of spray. And they no longer wear one of these long robes, and they don't mumble, no. They have a very elegant suit, and they preach like an evangelical pastor. They must have watched it very closely. How do you do that? And they have a total different kind of language, and that's the kind of people who attract the youth. So youth watches that, you see? And what do you think then the parents think is going to happen?
Lose the Muslim faith or Muslim faith.
They don't learn the proper Muslim faith. Again, end of the world. You know, it's the end of the world every day in so many ways that is near. So that is what we're looking at. We see this all somewhat highlighted, you know? Enlarged when we go to Europe. We saw all the problems you have back home. There's more or less enlarged when you come in Europe.
So what are those ones with the hair on the TV? What are they telling the young people?
Yeah, good question. They talk mostly about love. Oh. And remember, we have, I'm not sure. I don't think we talked about that Monday. But there is a huge difference between the law and, let's say, the heart or God and love. Now, what do extremists want?
Law.
Law. Because law you can put in a box, in a book. Law you can translate in rules. Love you can't. You see? Now, so what you see now in Europe is that these preachers become very popular among young people, and that the people who want to stress the law, they focus their battle on the youth who, you know, who might get different ideas from TV preachers, from Sufi. Have you heard of Sufi? Sufis? Yes. Mystical Muslims who also say it is between God and me. It's not just law, it's just between God and me. So that's what we have. We have this big drama going on of extremists wanting to present the law as one big system for all Muslims in Europe. Now, first of all, we know what the Islamic law is, right? The Sharia. Have you heard about that? Sharia. Do we know what's in the Sharia?
No.
Well, a lot. All the rules for worship. That is the part of the Sharia that is applied everywhere. It's the part how to pray, how to wash yourself, what to wear when you pray, what to say. That's in the Sharia. Then in the Sharia are the rules about clean and unclean, which is connected to the worship. For example, the food you can eat, which foods are forbidden, how do you make, if you, for example, somewhere and the only food available is forbidden. What do you do then? Do you just starve? Or can you somehow clean that food up? So that's the other kind of rules in the Sharia. The other rules in the Sharia, which are often applied, is the family law. The rules concerning the family law about marriage and divorce and child custody. And then the other rules in the Sharia are the ones we hear most about. Cutting of hands, the criminal law, the stoning to death of people who commit adultery and or fornication, and so forth and so forth. So you see, this Sharia law, this Islamic law is huge. Now, who of you gets the impression that it's the same everywhere you go? Who of you gets the impression that this Islamic law, it has one interpretation wherever you go?
No, sure.
Right, but that's what extremists like us to believe, that it is one law sent by God, descended on earth, you know, and this is what we must use. But if you look in the different countries where they have applied it or won't apply it, it looks like, and I now quote a Muslim colleague of mine, it looks like African tribal law. It's different wherever you look. You see, because that law was shaped over time, it was applied in communities, and some communities took this part and some communities took that part, and even the part of the worship is not the same. But the extremists say, no, we want Muslim law in Europe, and for that matter in America if possible, and in Canada. You've heard maybe the discussion in Canada where some groups want this Muslim law. That's what we want, so that all Muslims can be pure, correct, faithful, and following the right message. That's what they want. Now, and that is what brings me to the cartoon issue. Because that was the underlying issue in the whole cartoon discussion. Did we know that? Who knew that? You know. Tell us. He's from Australia. Well, that's why you listen to these things differently, right?
I might not actually answer your question exactly, but I read a column written by the cartoonist, the editor of the paper, about a month ago, in which he explained why he published the cartoons. And it was about four pages, but what came through to me was simply, it's time that you need to start to look at your rules, your culture, and laugh at it the same way that we laugh at our own rules and our own culture, because you're now living in an open Western society.
Right.
And you have to open the doors and look at what you're looking at.
Right. So what we have is we have the cartoon. So here we know, now we have here, we have the area where the battle within Islam is going on. Can we follow that? The area between law and love, so to speak. And then we could put in here between society and culture, between local society and an imagined society, like you live in Amsterdam and your head is still in Morocco. You see? That's a big battle. Then what the cartoon issue brought out was the huge battle, and I should now take this away, the honor and things, between the receiving society and the Muslim society. See, all of a sudden what came out in the cartoon issue, and it was really an issue waiting to happen, was that the people at home, the local people, the original people in the countries, got scared. Because one of the things that triggered this whole cartoon issue was that the editor of the Jutland Post said, "I want to stand up against extremists." That was the idea behind starting the issue. What went before that? A Danish writer had made a book on the Prophet Muhammad, the life of the Prophet Muhammad. And he was looking for someone to illustrate it, and he couldn't find anybody. Anyone he asked said, "I don't want to be killed like this filmmaker. No, I don't dare to." And that so distressed that editor, and at the same time, there were all kinds of things happening in Denmark. We all know that the cartoons came from Denmark, right? All kinds of things were happening. One incident is to me, a very, telling incident. A professor teaching in Copenhagen, and giving a talk, like we are here now, about Islam, had quoted the Quran in Danish, had referred to the Quran in Danish during his talk, and that, for that, they tried to kill him.
Yeah, that's right.
Right. Yeah. So that was the drop that, you know, filled the bucket, as we say in Dutch, that made the bucket overflow.
The true Quran can only be in Arabic, correct?
According to an extremist.
Okay.
According to an extremist, the true Quran can only be in Arabic. Because why is he so, stressing in Arabic?
He doesn't live by
culture. To keep it pure.
To keep it pure. Someone said their culture?
To unify it,
right. That because the moment you translate something, you interpret.
Yeah.
You don't want interpretation. What you want is everybody to quote in Arabic, whether you understand it or not, and someone of an extremist mind will interpret it for you. Because that's what often happens. People themselves, because the Arabic in the Quran is so difficult, that people don't understand what they're saying. That's what we forget. We think it's like us Protestants, and now also Catholics, right? You read it and you think about it. No, a lot of people read the Quran, and just reading it, doesn't matter what it says, makes it holy and helps you to become pure. Just the words are enough.
But this is exactly the same as fundamentalist Christians saying it has to be the King James Version.
Right.
Absolutely.
Right. Right.
But how often we say that Mexicans can't speak any of our songs in their language? It has to be
our language. Right. Right. It is a way. It's a method. It's a methodology to unify and to press your policy, to press your political program. That's what it is.
Pretty much, I kind of look at them as if they're still back in the Middle Ages, because everything was in Latin then, the people couldn't read.
Right.
The only thing they knew what to do is what the priest told them what to do.
Yeah.
It's really not that different, is it, from what Christianity was back in the
Absolutely. But the thing is, it doesn't mean that Islam is in the Middle Ages.
Mm-hmm.
But it is the same model. It's the same model. You read it in Arabic, you hear it in Arabic. The words by themselves are sufficient for your purification, your sanctification, and someone else can explain it. Okay, so back to the cartoon. So when after that happened, that editor who had lived, I think, in Iran, he had lived a considerable time of his career in a Muslim country, he said, we have to stand up to this, because where is this going to? What he was actually saying is, extremists are controlling the discourse about and within Islam in Denmark, and we have to somehow go against that and expose it. So that is why he then had this contest. How do you imagine Islam, or how do you imagine the Prophet Muhammad? And there were then 12 cartoons that made it and were published. And those 12 cartoons, as we know, caused an explosion all over the world. But this is not the end of the story, because the cartoons were published by October. Actually, there was an article about them in Egypt, in the newspaper. Nobody moved. Nobody said a word. But in the same time, there was this battle for power going on within Denmark, because now the more extremist-minded leaders saw a chance to prove to the community, and these are again Somalis, Turkish, Moroccans, and this is not one community, to prove to the Muslim community that they are in charge. That was the point. They wanted to show that they're in charge. So they cajoled the ambassadors of Muslim countries to go and protest with the prime minister, and the ambassadors didn't want. Then they threatened the ambassadors, and the ambassadors went. But the prime minister didn't want to receive them. He said, look, we have a free press. I didn't do this. You've got to go to the newspaper. And then he waited. But think about it. In the fall, we had Ramadan, the Muslim fast. Everybody hungry, focusing on fasting and extra prayer. No time for a riot in the world, right? Then we had Christmas. Nobody in Europe has time. Then we had the pilgrimage to Mecca. Muslim world has no time either for something big. When that all was over, he suddenly went to Al Jazeera and brought it on the TV, and he went to Palestine. Now, do you know who the one, this imam, this leader from Denmark, do you know who he is? Who read about him? Who heard him on NPR? I almost fainted when I heard him on NPR. I'll tell you why. Well, anyway, his name is Abu Lawan. He's a Palestinian, and that was the first country that started to riot. Did you notice? He's Palestinian, and he has been for 25 years in Denmark. He doesn't speak one word of Danish, and I know that because I met the man, and I heard his sermons. And 85% of his community, he preaches in Arabic, 85% of his community sits with headphones on. It looks as if you're kind of in some extraterrestrial station, because they all have this little antenna sticking out. and so they need translation into Danish. They see that they get the instant translation. And he is persona non grata in several Muslim countries because of his extremist ideas. So there we are. Denmark took care of him, you know. And so he wanted to show that he was the strong man, the leader of Muslims in Denmark. So this, what came out really, was not only the battle between the Danes and Muslims, so to speak, as there is a battle, but also the battle within Islam. And I know for a fact from Danish colleagues that, for example, he and his like-minded, you know, the like-minded members of his group forbade Muslims to have discussions with non-Muslims, to talk with the Danes. And then on NPR, and that's myself, I was like, well, I wasn't sure if I should faint or fall from my chair from laughing. It was kind of in between, because then on NPR, he said that he had brought these cartoons to the world to advance a dialogue between civilizations. Don't you love it? and actually, the interviewer, you heard the interviewer just swallow, thinking, oops, what am I going to say next? and then in the next sentence, he said, of course, I didn't want to put fuel on the fire. You know, that he wanted dialogue, but he didn't have dialogue in Denmark. Now, going back to Denmark, because we are talking, you know, you can really not talk about all the countries. Going back to Denmark, the Danish are not holy and clean either. Do we know that? Do we know that? What do the Danish do? What is the Danish political tone right now? Very right-wing, very ultra-right-wing, anti-foreigners, anti-everything that's Danish. You see? Now, where is the newspaper with Aya Nishi Ali? Hold it up. Show those of you who haven't seen it yet. Now I go back to the Netherlands to show you a little bit what's happening in Europe. This Aya Nishi Ali, this woman from Somalia, who was born and raised Muslim, but has become an atheist now. Actually, she is waging what she called a liberal jihad. A jihad for enlightenment. She and similar other Muslims who have actually become atheists, who fell from their faith, are now the ones really polarizing lots of societies in Europe. Because they come and say, all they focus on is what we had here, this honor killing, this female circumcision, the cultural aspects of Islam, and all they focus on is extremists. And they tell the Europeans, you are sitting on a ticking time bomb, right? And they totally ignore that a lot of the second and third generation has so integrated that, and now that's why I brought this economist that I got thanks to Tom. Tom has really saved me. He came in with all the material that I did not bring, thank you. You know, here it says that, for example, in France, 90% of the French Muslims don't go to the mosque either. Just like 90% of the French don't go to church. Right? But then the 10% that's in a mosque makes so much noise, and is so visible, and seems so densely populated in that mosque, because there are much less mosques than there are churches. So the idea is, oh my gosh, they're all terrorists. They all want to take over. But actually, There, this is. There have been a few books in Europe. I don't know if you heard about that. Now speak about Eurabia, and those books are, and they express this fear: we are going to be taken over. But the strange thing is, I myself from the Netherlands, right, which was after the murder of Van Gogh, which was also a hotbed of polarization and of violence in many ways. But when I speak to Muslim leaders and to people from the second or third generation who have an adequate or higher education, I don't feel that these people want to take over at all. All they want is to be left alone. They want to live their lives and be Muslims like I want to be a Christian. And for both of us, it's hard. Do you know that? You know that from Europe, right? For both of us, I mean, when I can give you one example. It's very small. I grew up in an extremely Calvinist church. It was so Calvinist, you were basically told twice a Sunday that you go to hell. And some people knew for sure they wouldn't be going, but most of us thought, well, we'll go to hell. So most of us thought, well, what's the use? I'm going to the cafe. I'm going to drink wine, beer, and so forth. I only have this small time to enjoy, and then I'll be in hell. So come on. That's one of the problems, you know? And so we all called ourselves atheists. I now realize we weren't, but that's what we called ourselves. Well, when I became a Christian again, I got letters from half of my friends, please never contact us again, will you? Because they thought, they were sure that I'd gone nuts. This woman has lost something. Because so now we come in the next point, that it's, you know, people like Ayaan Hirsi Ali bringing out the fear. Certain politicians, you know, reacting to that, enlarging the fear. Then this idea that all religious people are considered really weird. Do you know what I mean? You're from Australia. Do you have the same there?
Yes.
Really, really weird. Well, why are you religious? You don't need religion. Life is fine. You have everything you need, right? It's just a hassle to be religious. So you cannot say, neither in Denmark nor in the Netherlands, you cannot say out loud why you are religious in many circles. Not in all circles, but in many circles. So there you see the next problem. You see that religion is really looked upon as something scary, crazy, disturbing, and so forth and so forth. So that is the other thing. But if we read this, Then we come to the other point that we see in Europe. Now, let me stop for one second, by the way, to see if there are any questions, because as you see, I go on and on and on. I am from Europe. This is something that's so in my heart that, you know, and it is so huge. But is there any question or anything you want to say or any remark you want to make?
Nelly?
Yeah?
Up here.
There? Two questions? Yeah?
Yeah? You've talked about from the inside of the Muslim community in Europe, but there's this big question about, is Europe different than the United States?
Very.
And
yeah.
the basic notion is that when you come to the United States, you become American regardless of where you're from.
Yeah.
But that if you are an Algerian, you'll never be really French, or if you're an Indonesian, you'll never be really Dutch. So is there something about European society that makes it impossible for integration to take place?
You come to my next point, so thank you. Yeah, because this is a very important point. But I saw your hand.
Okay. Go ahead.
Did you have a totally different question?
Somewhat different question, yes.
Why don't you ask it, then I'll see if I can weave it in.
I have a question about why it is, many of the issues that you talk about are common to most immigrant communities, especially
right.
that our diaspora, for example, the Armenians,
right.
when they spread out after World War II, they maintained very unique communities. They had leadership, religious leadership coming from afar, but you don't see this sort of paranoia, you don't see this kind of spasmodic violence.
Right.
So what creates that difference for one diaspora, one type of religion, for that to form
right.
and another not?
Well, what creates the difference is the law. That's what creates a difference. A lot of Europeans are extremely afraid that in 50 years, Islamic law will reign Europe. And they don't realize that there are very few places where Islamic law actually reigns. Because as I say, nobody knows what it is. You know, they're all fighting about what, how to interpret it. And I love this one. I'll give you an example from Nigeria. You know, the north of Nigeria has some states that have now applied the Islamic law. And of course, the fact that they won that is because Nigeria is 50-50 Christian-Muslim. So the Muslims become what I call hyper-Muslims, which you have, of course, also in Europe. It becomes a hyper-identity, right? Now, if you are Armenian, you can be hyper-Armenian, but your Christianity fits in much better, right? But, for example, in Nigeria now, where they have these Muslim laws, there are still mixed communities, Christians and Muslims. And the rules are only for the Muslims, really, right? Now, so now they have this rule that women and men together cannot go out at night on the motorbike. How do you know what's on that motorbike? A special number plate, a Muslim or a non-Muslim. Now guess record sales. What has record sales? The non-Muslim motorbike plate. At night, all the Muslim motorbike plates change. Muslim motorbikes change their plate, and everybody goes out. Go, help yourself in trying to figure out who's who, because you can't see the difference. Everybody has long robes, and lots of women have something over their head. There's no way you can see the difference between a Christian and a non-Christian. So you see. There's so much going on, but now the question is why is this tension? The tension is, as I said, the first reason within the community is the religious authority, and that the fact that extremist-minded Muslims are really fighting a battle for the souls of these Muslims in Europe. They want them to join them. This did not happen to Armenians. This does not happen to. But we have battles. We have had battles for the soul of Christians. We have, you know, we have very ultra right Christians too. But the difference is this: there is no law, because we have the division between state and religion. We cannot put a law. They might try, but it won't work.
So it's more like a theocracy.
Yeah, that is it. What the extremist-minded Muslims want is a theocracy. But now this question that Tom raised is extremely, extremely important. Why do people so much better integrate here than in Europe? And tomorrow night I'm going to speak about the U.S. The first is that most of the Muslim population in the U.S. has far better education. Many of them are professionals, or they have a shop or business. They are very seldom are at the bottom of society doing the menial work. Very seldom. That's one reason. The second reason is that the European societies are quite hierarchic. They are very hierarchic. Do you know what I mean by that? I give you also an example. When I was small, there were very clear rules whom we could play with and whom we could not play with. There was, you know, the children of the pastor, the mayor, the banker could play with each other. Others could not play with them. And that was a very strict, unwritten rule. Never mind that the banker at that point was a farmer with a little room in his farmhouse that later on became the bank, but at first was open twice a week an hour for loans. But, you know, he was a banker. So it's very hierarchic. Now, this hierarchy used to be a hierarchy of social status, right? And here in the States, college, people going to college, and people who wanted to go to college or who could get a scholarship, even if you couldn't afford it, that became much more democratic here than it was in Europe. In Europe, it was only by the 60s that people from lower income groups or people from lower educated families could go to college, because the government gave loans. Before that, it was very well defined who could go to college. So that means what? You have an upper class that is a sort of, elite, and that perpetuates itself. The rest is also, you know, then you have the shopholders and then you have the menial workers. That is how society was divided in the Netherlands, in Germany, and so forth and so forth. Now, that has changed because now there is upward social mobility through the educational system. Who is now at the bottom? People who don't speak the language well. People who look different. People who dress differently. They are now at the bottom. So that is why a lot of the immigrants feel disowned. They feel disgruntled, they feel disowned, they feel that they are not taken for who they are. You know, who has been to Jody Kretzmann's lectures? Where he says, you know, you can focus on everything negative. And that's what happens to the foreigners. Everybody focuses on their negative sides, their negative aspects. Nobody looks at what can these people bring to our society. You know, okay, clean the toilets and go home. You know, that's the kind of the attitude. Now, but so their children suffer from that attitude. That's one thing. Then the other thing is the whole social system, and it's very interesting that this article mentions it. If you come here, I always say you get exactly 23 minutes to adapt. That's it. Then you can either, you know, sink or swim or sink. But you in all ways you are encouraged to get into society, learn English, and get a job, right? Well, if you go to the Netherlands or to Germany or to Denmark, you first are put in a group. If you are a refugee, you are a group. You are a refugee. You get that label. And so again, everything you cannot do is looked at, and you're put in certain housing, and you get a certain allowance till you finally have your permit to stay. This can take up to 5-6 years. So there you sit, bored stiff, in the housing, right? And the same is for a Moroccan worker when he or she loses their job. You come into this system where everything negative is going to be discussed about you. And you get, but you do get social security. You do get a monthly income that is 80% of your last income. And you can get that, now don't be shocked, for 40, 50 years. If you don't find gainful employment, they will keep paying you. And that is where another problem came up. In many of these countries, some Moroccans and some Turkish workers fell between the cracks or actually were sick. So they needed the money, you know, the social security, the sick leave money, and so forth. But others figured out the system. And that now is creating, again, a lot of hatred and a lot of anger. Like, you used my system and you just ate from my fruit tree. But at the same time, local people, the Dutch and the Danes and so forth, don't realize that they created a system that is so stuck, it drives me crazy. You know, when I go to the Netherlands, I mean, I can stand it 2 weeks. When you work in the Netherlands, when you actually join, has any of you worked in the Netherlands? We talked about that the other day, right? The bureaucracy just kills you. You know, if there is no form for something, it does not exist. That's it. So that is part of the, so it's a combination of the hierarchy and racism, because hierarchy creates, you know, division. Division means a certain form of racism, absolutely, which, you know, in the old days, it was, my grandfather belonged to the working class, and, you know, I remember how he was treated. And I remember how people, like the doctor in the village, they wouldn't listen to people like him. They didn't listen. If he would say, I have pain, they wouldn't ask him how and where and what and when. They just wouldn't treat him like a child. Till people like me grew up and came and barked at the doctor. And then we barked at, oh my God. So, but this is a human being. Can you listen to this man? He's not stupid. He just didn't have the education you had. You see? So you see, there's all these things going together. And so the second, third generation can also feel very much in between the cracks. And some of them then go and become completely against society. Now, against the receiving society. Now, one other thing. Should we stop? I hear clapping. No, we can still go on. One other thing that we should never forget is that I talked about education, I talked about, that something we forget too is that things are allowed in the West which are not allowed here. And that I'm very grateful again, that I always think, geez, I'm the only one seeing that, but this article mentions it too. There is, for example, so in Europe there are things allowed that are not allowed here, and then it goes too far, and people get too mad, you see? So this taking Social Security, living on the dole, and so forth, but also expressions of Islam and of feelings. There are groups in the Netherlands, in Denmark, Muslim groups that are forbidden in the Middle East. One of them is called Hizb ut-Tahrir. These kids, and I'm sorry, I don't want to insult those of you who are young in this audience, but they are mostly kids under 25, right? They come on TV and they say, our goal is to destroy the Danish state. What would you think if you hear that? You know, what would happen in the States if that would happen here? So there's also the freedom of speech that allowed the cartoons to be published, right? Also allows these voices. And again, people hear that, and one of the things that really rattled the Netherlands was someone saying that all homosexuals should be thrown off high department buildings. Mm-hmm. Think about it, or apartment buildings. Think about it, to say that on TV. And so the thing is also that because these laws are so open, and these societies in many ways are so open, but there is no respect for religion, these extremist groups use that space to put their voice out as the voice of Islam. So again, we come back to the lack of authority, and nobody stands up and says, I'm sorry, you're not speaking for me. You're going too far here, you see? That people say when there's an opinion poll, they will tell you, you know, in the opinion poll what they really believe and what they think, but they will not go on TV and talk back to these groups. Why? Because the average moderate Muslim also feels threatened. They feel very threatened because, you know, the fact that they are moderate and even secular doesn't mean they no longer believe, but they believe, you know, it has become internalized. There's the division between state and religion. They believe in the Quran, they fast, they read the Quran, but they might not go to the mosque. But they cannot stand up and say, you're wrong. Because extremists thrive on the fact that they present everything as correct. Now, this destruction of the Danish state and the Dutch state, for that matter, where does that come from? And now the cycle is full, we say. That comes from the homelands. Because for the longest time, Morocco, for example, did not allow its citizens to take on the Danish or the German or the Dutch nationality. So they were in between the two countries, you see? And when they were in the Netherlands, the Moroccan law was still applied to them. Mm-hmm. So if you went home for vacation, they would punish you for something that might have happened in the Netherlands and was considered to have happened under Moroccan law. Do you see what I mean? So you are, in a way, you are in between all these cultures, and so the receiving country, again, has terrible trouble understanding that. Plus, what you also then get is something very strange that we normally don't think about, that a lot of the professionals in society cannot be Muslims. We don't have enough, for example, police officers. We don't have people in the army who are Muslim, or not enough, because you have to be Dutch or Danish or German to do that. And so if you cannot join the society, you cannot do those things. And that is, again, is not the case in the United States. You can become US citizen, and they don't ask you, do you still have another passport? And you just say, I become a US citizen, and I'm a citizen, finished. But in Holland, you cannot do that. In Denmark, you cannot do that. So we have all these levels of in a way, obstacles. Levels of obstacles that are thrown in the way of these people, and that in a more or less show that the European societies were never prepared to receive all these new immigrants and all these people from outside And they happen to be Muslim, they could have been Hindu as far as I'm concerned. But then within the Muslim community, we have all these discussions and problems going on. And that's what, remember yesterday we talked about the Muslim Brothers on Monday, those of you who are here, because it is the Muslim Brothers who are pushing for this, you know, this unified, extremist-minded, and they are the ones who set up the big organizations in the different countries, and they are the ones who try to rule over the Muslims. Any questions? I saw several hands. I said, you were first.
Are they winning? In your estimation, are they just starting out?
Monday we talked about that. That started in the 70s, very short, and is funded mostly by Saudi Arabian money, oil money. It started in the 70s. A very, 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 you know, focused effort to Islamize the Muslims. So now we see the fruits of it. But again, nobody knows how many Muslims, if they would be free to express themselves, how many Muslims would follow these Muslim brothers, and how many would say, my foot. We don't know. That's the problem. We don't know. Because you don't dare to, you're in danger when you speak out.
So are you saying that they can't become citizens of those countries? They can't get citizenship?
No.
The Muslims can?
Moroccan, no. Certain countries, like Morocco, forbid them. Their home country forbids them. Turkey used to forbid it, but guess what changed Turkey's mind?
But it's not because of the European countries.
No, they would
allow them to become citizens.
Yes, they would allow. They want them to become citizens because they need police, Moroccan police men, because the majority of youth in jail now is Moroccan. they need people, the jail guards, but you have to be, like here, you have to be a US citizen to do these jobs. I don't think you can become a police. Can you become a police officer when you are just a green card holder? No, of course not.
But it's much harder to become citizens in European countries.
Well, it depends. If you have lived there for 10, 20 years, you can do it. You can apply, and there have been moments that the door opened much wider, mm-hmm. and people were allowed to. And then your children, when they are born there and go to the schools, you can do it. Yeah, but it used to be. It's true. It used to be much harder. Now the countries realize we have to, you know, take these people into our midst. Let's see. There was another hand here. Yeah, you were first, and then you.
What role does the low birth rate in the European countries play in this?
Very good question. Well, that's why we think, oh, we're going to be overtaken. The birth rate of the second and third generation of educated Muslims drops at the same rate. Mm-hmm. It drops from, you know, Dutch birth rate, I don't know what it is right now, 1.3 or something. And the moment the first generation, you know, has passed on, the people who are grown up, who grow up in the society, in the new society, their birth rate drops as well. So in a way, you know, demographically speaking, people think they're all going to take over, but demographically speaking, that might not happen as fast as we think. Yeah. And then the birth rate is also, it's going up and down in Europe because, you know, the birth rate in a place like the Netherlands and Germany is so low because they're so incredibly unemancipated. That's just, I don't know, were you aware of that? They are so unemancipated, it makes you sick. I mean,
which countries?
The Netherlands, Germany, Denmark. The thing is, most of my friends who did MAs, PhDs don't have full-time jobs. When the moment you want a family, you can't do it anymore as a woman in those countries. The system, in spite of all its, you know, wealth and social this and social that, they won't help you with childcare. No. And then you know, you have to, like, write your name on the list 5 years before the kid's born. Well, who can do that? So it's just the whole system. Oh, and something else. 12 o'clock in the Netherlands, all children go home for lunch. You can't work. That means as a mother, there's no way you can work. Yeah, you see all the mothers on their bike, getting the kids from school and biking back, and, you know, that's it. So that's one of the reasons why the birth rate is so low. So if the more, but now they're changing that. Once they start to help women by, you know, having careers, it might go up. Because it doesn't mean people don't want children. Yeah.
My head's still back to the Middle Ages.
Okay.
And the Christian church was stuck in a lot of problem with law
right.
back then.
Right.
Guilt. Is there any chance that we can get a Muslim Luther that can some Reformation, not just Luther, but all the rest of them? There was a great period of history where there were all these reformers who saw the problems, who still loved the faith. Can we get any Muslims that love the faith and can be a reformer?
Well, do we? Who? Those of us who were here Monday, we talked about the dream of that there is one caliph ruling over all the Muslims. So God forbid there's one Luther. Wait, because he would say, I'm the caliph, you know? We don't want that. No, but there are tons of Muslim Luthers. There's not one. But when you look at the Muslim world, both in Europe and in the States and in the Middle East and in the Far East, there are immense numbers of people who see that we need change.
So that's a little bit of hope.
There's a lot of hope.
Good.
But the more hope there is, the more extremists will fight. Because as I say, there's a huge battle going on, and they see they're losing that battle. Because as I said Monday, the big enemy is secularism, feminism, and of course, Zionism, right? Israel, and the occupied territories. Those are the big enemies in the mind of extremists. And so they don't want Muslims to become secular. But you go to any Muslim country and you will see so much secularism you can't believe your eyes. You know, and if you talk to Muslims, you realize it's very much like being a Catholic with a Pope. You know, you choose yourself in the end. I mean, I meet so many Catholics who have used birth control, although the Pope says you can't, because you, and so here is the magic word, individualism. The moment the Muslim moves to the West or watches CNN, and Monday we came to the conclusion that every house in Egypt has a dish on the roof, you get a growing individualism, like I can choose, and people will choose, you see? So think about these poor extremists, the battle they have to wage, you know? So, and it looks very much like the Reformation, when then, you know, the ones who wanted to, the tradition to stay as it was just started to fight back, and you had these terrible wars. So that is, in a way, what the Muslim world is going through. Were there other questions, or do you want to rush to the next building? Yeah?
I suppose everybody in the room knows this but me. Why do they hate the Jews so much?
Well, that is a very complicated question. First, of course, Israel. No Muslim ground should ever be converted to non-Muslim ground. And they consider Israel as having been Muslim ground in the Ottoman Empire. Never mind, there lived lots of Christians and Jews, but it was Muslim ground because it was the Ottoman ruler, the Ottoman Sultan, who ruled over it. But secondly, the Quran is of an extremely divided mind about Christians and Jews. Christians are okay-ish. Yeah. There's good and bad about them, and that is, as far as I can see with my cynical Western mind, because the Prophet Muhammad didn't really know very many Christians. So he didn't, but the Jews, as the time goes on, where the Prophet Muhammad, who started his message in Mecca as a very universal message saying, I am here to correct and to build on Judaism and Christianity. That was the first idea in the first years in Mecca. That was 13 years. That was his idea. Then he had to flee from Mecca to Medina. In Medina, there were three big Jewish tribes. And all of a sudden, he has competition. And he tells these Jewish tribes, look, I have this cool message, and I think we'll all be one. And the Jew says, no way, what you're saying is nonsense. You can't have that when you want to set up your own religion. You see? So in Medina, we see the tone of the Quran changing, and it becomes very negative about the Jews. And every time there is a conflict between the Prophet and the Jewish tribes, the Quran commends with something extremely negative.